Part 6. The Host. Swami Trigunatitha, builder of the old temple, had planned the top floor as quarters for Swami Brahmananda, first president of the order, whom he had hoped to persuade to occupy it for at least some months. Whether Maharaj seriously considered it, I do not know. Certainly in India they had no intention of seeing their beloved chief off on such a sea voyage, involving a lengthy absence from headquarters. So the floor was now used as headquarters for the Swami in charge. Swami Ashokananda's lifestyle and ours below, though equally simple and ascetic, were not outwardly synchronous. Swami never ate with us. It was his custom at Christmas to give each of us some rather elegant gift, usually clothing or a book. One year, I understand, when he asked John what he would like for Christmas, the latter replied, "For you to come down and eat the dinner with us, Swamiji." And he did. He had many dietary restrictions, and he ate at no set hours, but only when he felt hungry, or was told to eat, or perhaps when he remembered to eat. The same was true of his sleep. Anyone awake in the night might hear the padding of his feet above, or the distant sound of the radio. Afternoons it was not uncommon to find him napping, but this might have been true at any hour of the day, had we been in the habit of going up unannounced. He would sometimes spend the entire night in the study of his books, on his projects, or doing his own spiritual practices. Even less pattern was discernible as he grew older. Swami's quarters consisted of a large bedroom, kitchen, bath, and a smaller back bedroom leading to the roof garden. It was his custom, whenever a brother monk came to visit, to stuff himself into this little room and leave the spacious one to his guest. Barring that, he left the back room in glorious disarray. "I have to keep one room like that," he told one of us. "Life is not all just hunky-dory." Hunky-dory came out in lectures also, bringing bright smiles to the faces of the devotees. Swami often used slang expressions, some of which were gleaned from a faithful following of the comics section of the newspaper. The Bumpsteads, Blondie and Dagwood, were among his favorites. He brought the house down one Sunday morning by interrupting the lecture to ask rhetorically, "Why is it, I don't understand, that Dagwood never locks the bathroom door?" With a mind of this type, out of which a two-hour discourse could emerge without a note, and keyed up for hours of the day to a pitch of highest discrimination, will it be any surprise if Swami had ways of achieving relaxation? In the modes available to him, he clearly attempted to maintain the balance and vigor of a healthy mind. I mentioned his listening to the radio. He also had a turntable and record albums and liked music very much. He used to hum or sing softly any time of day. On the few evenings he was not downstairs, he might play records, often classical Western music. The selection I best recall was the definitive Landowska recording of the Goldberg Variations for Harpsichord of John Sebastian Bach. He had told Al that in Bengal he had had a room close to that of a European who played such records loudly, and Swami had thus been forced to hear them, But after a while, he gained some understanding of the music. He would also play records of Bengali devotional songs, some of which sounded glorious to us as the strains wafted down from that distance. And when he joined his own full voice to the music, expressing an evidently ecstatic mood, it was a treat for the ears of the gods. His silent source of relaxation and recreation was the detective story. Swami must have gone through reams of them. As I knew little at that time of the titles and authors, I cannot delineate his taste in mysteries. Eclectic, I suppose. Some of the devotees knew his predilection and were able to keep him supplied. Sometimes books were offered almost ritualistically. Swamiji, I bought this today. You please read it first, and then I shall take it as prasad. He told someone that the mystery stories were valuable to him in exposing the nature of the human mind. As virtually all of them must have had a Western setting, we may well understand what this may have contributed to his ability to minister spiritually to Westerners. I have heard that on the eve of Swami Ashokananda's ocean voyage to the United States, he was given reminders by some of his friends and co-workers in India not to forget them. Some even hinted that in such a rich country, he would be likely to get enough funds to be able to send some over for their work. Swami is said to have made it clear that he was turning his face westward. Quote, "All the funds that come my way, I shall put back into the work there. Do not expect to hear from me. I am leaving India behind." That was his conception of where his duty lay. His ability to carry this out successfully must have been partly responsible for Swami's achievements in the West. He remained in touch with a very few close friends. We get a small glimpse into his early life in India through one of his oldest friends whom I met there, a fellow student in college in Sylhet, Swami Saumyananda. He described Swami Ashokananda as an intellectual giant from early in his life. He spoke of how he had organized classes for the boys of the poor cobblers of the village of Habiganj, raising their status conclusively. When no raft or boat was available, the future Ashokananda would jump into the river and swim to his classes. In San Francisco and Berkeley, I was witness to some of the visits paid by his best friends in this country, a most beloved one being Swami Vividishananda of Seattle, to whom, then in charge of the San Francisco Center, Swami had come as assistant in 1931. For some years he came nearly every summer, and when this elderly Swami needed cataract operation, Swami Ashokananda brought him from Seattle to the old temple, placed him under the care of the best surgeons in one of our fine hospitals. He asked me to nurse the Swami, both in hospital and at the temple afterward. What fun they would have, teasing each other, speaking Bengali, and talking shop. The same fun went on when Swami Pavitrananda would arrive from New York, as he too did almost annually. Swami Akhilananda from New England, though a less frequent visitor, was a great favorite with all, and he gave a question and answering session, which was much appreciated. Readers who knew Swami Satprakashananda of St. Louis may enjoy an anecdote of one of his visits related by E.C. Brown. Mr. Brown had among his assignments in those old days the duty of standing at the back of the old temple lecture hall on Sunday to see that all went well. Swami Satprakashananda on this day was the guest speaker, but even before beginning to chant or talk, he was looking steadfastly in Mr. Brown's direction, while, with arm upraised, he opened and closed his fingers in imitation of a mouth. Mr. Brown fortunately knew just what to do. He ran up the back stairs, that's two flights, found the forgotten dentures, and managed to struggle them into the speaker's lectern at the other end of the hall. Swami Vishwananda of Chicago made rare visits, and Swami Vijayananda, on a trip north from Buenos Aires, stopped with us once in my time. Swami appreciated all of them, taking them to the branch centers and showing sights of the city invariably made him noticeably more ill. Pulled down was a favorite Indianism after these fraternal get-togethers. The brother monks no doubt chatted for hours in their quarters. From below, all we could hear were the great guffaws which provided occasional punctuation. The story is told of Swami Vivekananda at Ridgely Manor in New York that a boy passing Swamiji's room heard him laughing to himself. Finally, he looked in and asked the Swami why he was laughing. "Oh, God is so funny," was the answer.